My day in court with David Irving was convicted several months ago and sentenced to 3 years in prison in Austria under its laws criminalizing those who deny the Holocaust. Lipstadt spoke in Portland in January.
Thank you. Thank you for that very generous introduction. Arden said when he said I was number two, for that was for the year 2000, the year in which I won the trial. Though when the list came out, someone emailed me because Joe Lieberman was number one, and the person's comment was, he lost, you won. So, in any case, it's a pleasure being here. And what I'd like to do tonight is talk a little bit about the trial. I will talk towards the end about my feelings about the arrest of David Irving and the quote that, or the thing that prompted me to say what was quoted in the Spiegel and has been quoted in many places in recent weeks in terms of Irving's arrest. As Arden mentioned in his introduction, in 1993 I wrote a book, was published in 93, called Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory. And it was an attempt to explain who Holocaust deniers are, what their modus operandi is, and essentially it made the argument that Holocaust denial is naught but a form of anti-Semitism, and in many cases a form of racism, and something that appeals certainly to racists. If you go on any site of extremist racists, and I think that may be a redundancy, you will find them engaging, amongst other things, in Holocaust denial. In the book was not about David Irving. I devoted maybe 300 words to David Irving. And I described him as a Holocaust denier, by implication as a racist and an anti-Semite. And I said two things, that A, he knows the truth because he was familiar with the documents. He was a writer of works on Holocaust history. He wasn't just someone who was a plain old Holocaust denier, but he had a reputation as a someone who wrote extensively on the history of World War II. In fact, if there are any people in this audience who are military history buffs, you know the name David Irving, because his work was sometimes controversial, but often cited, and people knew it as a military historian. He was one of the people for propagating the myth of the terrible Allied damage to Dresden. I mean, there was damage, but Irving aggrandized it and blew it up in a very extensive fashion, and more about that in a few moments. So I said he's someone who knows the documents and twists them to make them comport with his Holocaust denial arguments. And I also said, because he has this reputation as this writer of historical works, that he was the most dangerous of deniers. Because unlike other deniers who were known simply as being deniers, he had this separate reputation. And people would say, oh, David Irving's a denier. Well, maybe there's something to it. Maybe there's some aspect of the Holocaust that is exaggerated or aggrandized or whatever it might be. The book came out in the United States, and then in Germany, Switzerland, Japan, etc. At least they tell me it was my book in Japan. I got these two little volumes. In Japanese, it was a two-volume book. And on the cover, my picture was on the cover, but I have no idea what was in it. But I did find someone who read Japanese who assured me that it was my book. But then it was bought by Penguin UK, and it came out in the United Kingdom. And as soon as it came out in the United Kingdom, within a few months after coming out in the United Kingdom, I received a letter from Penguin UK saying that Irving was thinking of suing me for libel. And given that it was this legal battle was going to occupy a minimum of 6 years of my life, subsequent 6 years of my life, that it would cost my defense fund, which I didn't know I would have, but it would ultimately cost the defense fund about $1.7 million. It would take tremendous time and toll and material resources for me as well. And then I would be back in court just last year again fighting Irving on a related issue. I had what was probably a very inappropriate reaction when I received the letter. I laughed. I thought it was very funny. Little did I know. But the reason I thought it was funny or amusing, I mean, not in that sense, was because here was a man who in court, he had testified in a Canadian court at a trial of a Holocaust denier, that, and he had used the word legend. He said, the Holocaust is a legend. I've seen evidence that it never happened. Here was a man who went around giving speeches saying to people, not in his academic, not he was never an academic, but not in his scholarly historical guise, but in his Holocaust denial sort of discussions, he would say, I'm going to form an organization called Auschwitz Survivors, Survivors of the Holocaust, and Other Liars, and call it by its acronym, assholes. And they would say things like, more people died in Senator Kennedy's car at Chappaquiddick than died in gas chambers at Auschwitz. So a man who, or when his, he had written a book on Hitler called Hitler's War, in which he made the rather ludicrous, came out in 78 before he was a denier, and first edition came out in 78, and in it he made what's going to sound like a ludicrous argument that Hitler didn't know about the Holocaust, and when he found out about it, he tried to stop it, and he was the best friend the Jews had in Germany. When that book was reissued in 91, many people thought the book was terrific. Serious historians like a John Keegan, who's a great fan of David Irving's, even though he's a Holocaust denier, and thinks that he's just a little misguided. Keegan wrote, you know, well, that part is ridiculous, but the rest of the part of the book is good. And my argument would be, if a man can make an argument like that, doesn't it shed make you doubt the rest of his arguments? But no, Keegan doesn't see it that way. In any case, when that book was reissued by Irving in 91, all mention, after he had become a Holocaust denier, all mention of the Holocaust had disappeared. And when a reporter from the London Times said, how come all mention of the Holocaust has disappeared? Irving said, if something didn't happen, you don't even dignify it with a footnote. So here he was saying that publicly to a reporter from one of the leading newspapers in England, making these statements. So when I called him a Holocaust denier, I didn't think I was doing anything radical. And others had called him far worse and described him as that. So I wasn't going out on a limb. I wasn't courting a lawsuit or anything. What I didn't know, and probably if had I known it, I wouldn't have laughed when I first got the letter, was that in England, the libel laws are the mirror image of American libel laws. In America, if I say you libeled me, the onus is on me to on you to prove. If I say you libeled me, the onus is on me to prove that you indeed libeled me. In England, if I said you libeled me in something you wrote or slandered me in something you said, you have to prove that what you wrote or what you said is true. So the burden is on the defendant, on the author, to prove that what she wrote is true, as opposed to on the claimant or the plaintiff to prove the falsehood. So as soon as I understood that, I realized that my options were quite constrained. Because if I didn't fight it, he would win by default. And if he won by default, he could then say, the Royal High Court in London found that Deborah Lipstadt indeed libeled me when she called me a Holocaust denier. Ipso facto, I'm not a Holocaust denier. And my definition of the Holocaust then is a legitimate definition. And what is his definition of the Holocaust? Well, that there was no Nazi program to kill the Jews, that some Jews may have died, some Jews may have been murdered, but they died and murdered as a result of rogue actions, separate actions, independent actions by out-of-control officers or out-of-control soldiers or out-of-control allies of the Germans, but not by any organized action by the Germans, that there were no gas chambers. And that the number 6 million is a completely phony number, and the survivors who claim that this is the case are either liars or psychopaths or in it for the money. He once said to a survivor with whom he appeared in on Australian television, he pointed at the number tattooed on her arm, a number from Auschwitz, and said, how much money have you made from having that number tattooed on your arm? So once I realized the seriousness of the matter, at the recommendation of my own lawyer in Atlanta, I decided that it was important for me to get someone to represent me. I couldn't just depend on Penguin's lawyers, because publishers often don't stand behind their authors. I needed someone who would have my interests at heart. So I called a friend of mine in England who works for an organization that fights anti-Semitism and fights racism. And I told him he knew about the case because the papers had been filed in court, and of course he had the public filing, so he knew about it. He said to me, it's a good thing you called, Deborah, because just a few recently, a solicitor, a relatively young solicitor here in England, approached me and said, he knew I knew you. He said, if Deborah Lipstadt calls you about finding representation here in London, please tell her that I'd be willing to represent her. And then he said, this solicitor is one of the smartest and one of the cleverest people I know. He is assertive in the extreme on behalf of his clients. He cannot abide anti-Semites in any manner, shape, or form. And he said he would represent you pro bono if necessary. So having heard all the necessary words, you know, smart, clever, aggressive, pro bono, I said, what's his name? And my friend said to me, his name is Anthony Julius. And I right away, that name rang a bell, and I said, I sort of, it was 90s, this was 96, so I began to, I twirled my mental Rolodex. If it was today, I would say I began to scroll through the names in my PDA, but that was before we had scrolling PDAs at that point, or at least I did. So I said, oh, I know that name, and then it dawned on me, it clicked how I knew that name. I said, isn't he the author of a book on T.S. Eliot and anti-Semitism and literary criticism? All the reviews of this book, which had been published by Cambridge University Press, made note of the fact that the author was a lawyer in England who, while working full-time as a lawyer, had gotten bored. Now, some of you may be lawyers and may relate to the story, but here's probably where the similarity ends. And while working full-time as a lawyer, had gone back to university to get a PhD in literary theory. And this was his dissertation on T.S. Eliot, which Cambridge University Press was publishing without having changed a comma. So, yeah, it was pretty daunting. So my friend began to laugh when I said this and laugh at me. Clearly he was laughing. I had said something which tickled him. And when he stopped laughing, I remembered something else that the reviews had all said about Anthony Julius, that he was Princess Diana's lawyer. So I said, oh, isn't he also Princess Diana's lawyer? And my friend said, Deborah, that's why I'm laughing. You're the only one I know who would say, author of a book on T.S. Eliot, Cambridge University, and also Princess Diana's lawyer. Anthony had represented the late Princess of Wales in a number of press and libel suits, which is specialty, and then in that, she asked him also to represent her in that divorce suit. But as soon as he stepped in, a number of things happened. First of all, of course, the case began to get even higher profile starting in the UK because of his high profile in the UK. But much more importantly, we began to devise a forensic strategy. And Penguin UK's lawyers, who really played catch up on this aspect, went along with it wholeheartedly. And the forensic strategy was as follows. First of all, that as much as possible, and of course your strategy in battle, your strategy, whether it's a courtroom battle, whether it's a military battle, is only as good as until you meet your opponent. But our strategy was that as much as possible, we would try to not let this become, if it went to trial, a did the Holocaust happen case. Because we felt it's not necessary to prove the Holocaust happened. The Holocaust is a fact. There's certain aspects of it which you can debate. The origins of the Final Solution, how certain things happened, who was responsible for certain. There's much to debate, which historians debate, but not whether it happened or not. And instead, what we wanted this to be, as would be the case in any libel suit, that Deborah Lipstadt told the truth when she wrote what she wrote. And we would prove it, tactically, we would prove it by going through his work, essentially tracking his footnotes back to their sources, and showing, indeed, that he was not only a Holocaust denier, but that he lied and that he fabricated, and that all the things I said about him were the truth. Now, the implication of that would be that though he was the plaintiff and I was the defendant, for all intents and purposes, in the course of the trial, the roles were switched because he was ended up having to defend his own work. We would say, you know, we went through his work and we put his work on trial to prove that what I had said was correct. Anthony also said to me, together with his partner James Lipson, who was instrumental in helping formulate this strategy, that if we did go to trial, they would not call Holocaust survivors as witnesses. And that was for a number of reasons. And I know there are a number of survivors here with us tonight. And many survivors were distressed when they heard this because they thought we were sort of diminishing their importance, and that was not at all the case. The reason we were not going to call survivors, we did not call survivors as witnesses, was there were a couple. First of all, survivors as witnesses, they would have been witnesses of fact, not expert witnesses, but witnesses attesting to the fact that this happened. And we didn't think we needed witnesses of fact. The fact that it happened, we were taking as a given, A. B, the Irving does not contend that Jews didn't weren't imprisoned and suffered. He argues that many of them deserved that, but his contention is that there were no gas chambers or programmed murder by the Nazis. And of course, there are very few people can personally, in a legal way, attest to having seen that. There were some Jews who survived who could, people who worked in the gas chambers who, as forced labor, were forced to do that. But they have all died. They did testify at trials right after the war, and we did rely on their testimony from those trials. But the main reason we didn't call survivors as witnesses was that Irving was acting pro se. He was a litigant in person. He was representing himself. And we didn't think it was ethical to ask a elderly person, survivor of the Holocaust, to go into a witness box to be cross-examined by a man whose objective we assumed would be to humiliate them. Not to extract information, but to confuse them. Say you arrived on May 14th, 1944 in Auschwitz and your family went directly to the gas chambers. How's that possible? We know on May 14th the gas chambers weren't operating. This document, of course, in order to make that kind of argument, you have to say they were operating on other days, but don't confuse me with the facts, you know. But you could do that kind of thing. You can confuse people easily. Off by, especially about something that's so chaotic and traumatic as this. Instead, we determined that we would assemble, and we did assemble, a dream team of historians, whom we asked to go and to track his footnotes to prove our point that indeed he was a denier and a liar, and they did that. That dream team of historians was led by Professor Richard Evans of Cambridge University Press, who was our lead historical witness. He was joined by Robert Jan van Pelt, a specialist from Canada, from Toronto, who is one of the world's experts on the history of Auschwitz and of the gas chambers and the operation of the gas chambers, and Christopher Browning, who used to teach at Pacific Lutheran University, who is an expert on the perpetrators, on Hitler, they were joined by two German professors, Peter Longerich, also an expert on Hitler, and Hayo Funke, a political scientist, an expert on extremism, and who knew a lot about Irving's connections with extremists. Now, to turn from the sort of forensic strategy to how they did their work, let me give you some examples when I say we asked them to track the footnotes and to prove that the guy was a liar. I'll give you two or three examples. Well, the first example would be from before the Holocaust itself. 1923, those of you who remember World War II history, or European history, you probably remember that in 1923, November 9th, 1923, the then-fledgling Nazi Party attempted to overthrow the Weimar government, the Munich Putsch, which of course was a failure. And Irving, in writing about that 1923 putsch, writes that on the night of the putsch, Hitler was in a room with the leaders of the party waiting for reports from the field, were people joining up in the revolution against the much maligned Weimar government. And he was told, as the reports were coming in, he was told that a young member of the Nazi party, a lieutenant, former lieutenant in the German army, had trashed a Jewish-owned delicatessen. According to Irving, Hitler got very upset, was livid with rage, and had this young lieutenant brought to him. Middle of the putsch, he's, bring that lieutenant to me. The lieutenant is brought, and Hitler, in front of everyone, threw him out of the Nazi party for having led this raid on this Jewish-owned delicatessen. And that Hermann Göring, who was standing there, goggled at this exchange of Hitler throwing this lieutenant out for having trashed this Jewish-owned delicatessen. Then Irving gives as a footnote for that, a source for that, the 6,000-page trial transcript of Hitler's trial. Remember, Hitler is arrested by the Weimar government, put in jail for a short while. While he's in jail is when he writes Mein Kampf, and he comes out in 1924. Now, first of all, that's already a red flag. You're citing an incident. I see a lot of students in the audience. You cite an incident. You don't give us a footnote. I'll look it up in the 6,000-page trial transcript. You generally give what's called the page number. Well, Irving said it was microfiche. She said, maybe I read microfiche and I didn't have page numbers. Then the judge said, maybe or not maybe, you know, holding his feet to the fire. He said, well, I don't remember. But even if it's microfiche and it doesn't have page numbers, you give a date. You give something that makes the reader who wants to see the exact source, makes it easier for them to check, not that they're going to have to turn through 6,000 pages. Well, we had two terrific research assistants, and they went through and they found the story. And it was a little different than the way Irving reported it. Now, first of all, the story itself came from the testimony of a police sergeant, a man named Hoffmann, who himself was a member of the Nazi Party. He was testifying at Hitler's trial about this incident. Now, it's important that he himself is a member of the Nazi Party, so close to Hitler that the judge disallows his testimony because he says it's very nice for you to want to testify on the behalf of your Führer, but you're so close to him that we can't take you as an objective witness. So that's important when you're reporting on something, because especially if it's going to be something that's going to be critical of Hitler, it's coming from a supporter, so much of a supporter that his testimony is disallowed. And what does Police Sergeant Hoffmann testify? He testifies that indeed, on the night of the putsch, someone said to Hitler, you see that young lieutenant sitting over there? 3 weeks ago, he led a raid on a Jewish-owned delicatessen. So already the tenor has changed. It's not like Hitler saying, oh, the raid just was now, stop the revolution, whoever's in, go bring me that loot. But the man is sitting right there. And when he went and trashed the Jewish-owned delicatessen, he took off his Nazi Party insignia. So no one who saw him trashing the delicatessen would know he was a member of the Nazi Party. At which point, Hitler called him over and said, because you took off your Nazi Party insignia, suggesting that you're embarrassed to be a member of the Nazi Party, I'm throwing you out of the party. A little different, right? And no mention whatsoever of Göring being there, much less that he goggled at the exchange. And in fact, when Irving was in the witness box, my barrister, that in England it's divided between solicitors who prepare the case and barristers up to trial and barristers who are the litigators in court. Barristers are the guys in the wig, you know. But in any case, my barrister said to Irving, Mr. Irving, how did you know that Hermann Göring was there, much less that he goggled at the exchange? And Irving said, with no compunctions, oh, that was author's license. Well, that's not how a historian works. You don't just assume that Göring was there and assume that he goggled at an exchange, which is entirely different than what it says in the actually happened. Give you another example, Kristallnacht. 15 years later, same night in Munich, the Nazi leadership is all present in Munich to celebrate the 15th anniversary of the putsch. And a word comes that von Rath, the German diplomat who had been shot by this young Jew, Herschel Greenspan, in Paris, has died. And the Germans are going to use this as an excuse to launch Kristallnacht, which clearly had been well prepared before. Because it goes along almost carbon copy lines in every city. Lists are already prepared of who's going to be arrested, how it's going to be done. Hundreds and hundreds of synagogues are burned. Jewish stores are trashed. Jewish homes are broken into and completely trashed. Jews are terrorized, arrested, thrown out of windows. It's just a horrible, it's a pogrom of the worst order on that night. And Irving writes that when reports were given to Hitler about what was going on in many German cities, he was livid with rage and he called for an end to the outrages. And Irving gives as a proof of this call for the end of the outrages a telex that is sent out from a Nazi Party, the headquarters in Munich where the leaders are gathered, which reads, arson against Jewish shops and the like is to be ended. So it comes out in the middle of the night. I think it's 1:56. I forget the exact time that it goes out. It's not from Hitler, but it's from those very close. It's from one of Himmler's second in command, etc., those very close to the Nazi hierarchy. Out to the field, ordering, out to these cities where all these outrages are happening, and happening in every German city. Arson and against Jews, against Jewish-owned shops and the like is to be stopped. Now, why were they calling for an end to arson? Because arson can't differentiate. If you burn a synagogue, and next to the synagogue is a business that is owned by non-Jews, the fire doesn't say, oh, we stop here at the barrier because we're only supposed to be burning Jewish-owned enterprises. Entire blocks were going up in fire. So that's why they called for the end of arson. They didn't call for the end of the trashing of Jewish homes and Jewish stores. They didn't call for the end of terrorizing of people. They didn't call for the end of all the other things. But Irving says this is proof that Hitler was demanding an end to the outrages. So it's taking a thing about a very specific incident, part of the end of this entire event, terrible event, and turning it into something that it isn't.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Radio Zine on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
I'll give you yet another example. April 1943, Hitler and Foreign Minister Ribbentrop meet with Admiral Horthy. Admiral Horthy was the then head of the Hungarian government. Eventually, they are allies of the Germans, but eventually the Horthy and his government will be replaced by a Nazi government. The Nazis will put in their own government, in part because they're worried about the Hungarians possibly making a separate peace with the Allies, and B, they're upset with the Hungarians because though they had put in pretty draconian laws, anti-Semitic laws against the Jews, they had refused to allow the Jews to be deported. So, and Hitler and Ribbentrop were meeting with Horthy to push him to allow the Jews to be deported. So the meeting is a two-day meeting, and on the first day of the meeting, Horthy says to Hitler, well, what do you expect me to do to allow the Jews to be deported so that they should die like beasts in the field? And on that day, Hitler says, no, that's not necessary. On the second day of the meeting, I believe is April 15th and 16th, or 16th and 17th, on the second day of the meeting, Horthy asked the same question. And first, Ribbentrop says the Jews should be exterminated or taken to concentration camps where they would die. So that's right away a quite telling admission of what goes on. And then Hitler launches into what can only be described as a murderous harangue, with really blood dripping from every word. The Jews are like a tuberculous bacilli. If they're not put down, they spread their disease. Even the innocent animal who carries this bacilli has to be killed. It's clear when you read it that this is a program for murder. Now, how does Irving represent this event? He actually quotes Hitler's murderous harangue, but he quotes it and puts it up so that that happens on the first day of the meeting. And his rendition of the meeting ends, Irving's rendition of the meeting ends, with Horthy's question, do you want me to take the Jews out that they should die like beasts in the field? And Hitler saying, no, that's not necessary. Well, he said that, but he said that on the first day. But if you turn the 2 days around, the sequence of the 2 days, any reader thinks, well, he's saying, no, don't kill them. He takes Ribbentrop's statement, which is, again, the Jews should be exterminated, and he buries it in a footnote. Statement like that, when you're talking about an incident like that, deserves to be in the text of the thing. So again, it gives the reader a very different impression of what happened. Then he does something else. Apparently anticipating that the reader is going to wonder, why is Hitler so concerned about deporting the Jews from Budapest? So he wants to give the reader a legitimate reason in his defense of Hitler. He is this great admirer of Adolf Hitler. And he says that this, of course, was the time of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, where the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto were rising up against the Germans with arms supplied to them by troops retreating from the east. Now, first of all, I don't know what troops were retreating from the east that were supplying arms to the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. That's a completely fabricated kind of notion. But more importantly, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising took place in mid-April, but it occurred 2 days after this meeting. So this, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, in other words, what Irving is suggesting is that the reason Hitler was worried about all these Jews in Budapest was because there was this Warsaw Ghetto Uprising and he didn't want the same thing happening in Budapest. But the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising hadn't happened yet. And it wasn't like the Germans knew, oh, it's coming in 2 days. It was a surprise. So, again, the reader is left with an entirely convoluted impression of what the evidence is. And Irving does that over and over again. We provided the court with well over 30 different examples of these kind of lies, of these kind of fabrications, where either you had a switching of a date, or you had putting someone at, like Goring, at a meeting who wasn't there, or adding a word that didn't belong there. Change at one point, a judge in Nuremberg said about one thing that a witness said, this I don't believe. And when Irving reported on what the judge had said, he said, the judge said, she's a bloody liar, I don't believe a word she's saying. Well, the judge didn't say that. He said, this, on this particular incident, I don't believe. Or adding, changing, fabricating. And as Richard Evans said, they found it not in many, not in most, but in every single time they tracked a footnote where Irving wrote about the Holocaust, they found some kind of fabrication. I mentioned Dresden. Let me tell you a little bit about what he does with Dresden. Now, many of you in this audience, when you mention the bombing of Dresden, the February 13th, 1945, Allied bombing of Dresden, your feeling is that it was the closest, well nigh to an Allied war crime. It was unnecessary. It came at the end of the war. The Allies were destroying this wonderful medieval city just as a sort of gotcha to the Germans. Dresden had no military significance, and that hundreds of thousands of Dresdeners died in this terrible firebombing of the city. Well, the facts of the matter are really quite different. The fact of the matter is that Dresden had a great deal of military significance. It was filled with factories that were producing all sorts of machinery for the German war machine. It was a railway hub through which over 10,000 officers and soldiers were, German soldiers and officers were passing through every day. These factories were spread out all over Dresden. And we're producing things for the Luftwaffe, for the German army, calibrated equipment, etc., etc. And the fact is that according to the Nazi-era Dresden police, and Dresden was a highly Nazified city, the number of dead was between 30 and 35,000. Not a small number for a night and a day of bombing, but not the 100,000 Irving talks about. Sometimes he goes as high as 250,000. Quite a difference. So you might wonder, in general, how did we get this mistaken notion of Dresden? And by the way, there's a new book on Dresden. It's about a year old, which is really quite excellent, by a British historian, Frederick Taylor, called Dresden, February 13th, 1945. And Taylor asks, why did we get this mistaken notion of Dresden as this awful Allied war crime? And he cites three sources. First of all, Goebbels, who, and this is very typical for a totalitarian regime, as the Allies were more freely bombing more and more German cities in 45, Goebbels, instead of saying to the German people, we're withstanding this bombing, etc., was taking the death toll, like he took the Dresden police death toll of between 25 and 30,000, that's what it was, and he adds a zero, and he says, they've killed over 250,000 people. Because his feeling was, if I scare the German people into showing how many Germans there the Allies are killing, they'll be more motivated to fight to the very last person. Instead of saying, it's okay, we're withstanding it, they might feel, well, we'll surrender or something like that. So that was one source. The second source of the our notion in the West of this bombing of Dresden really comes from the East Germans, the communist East Germans, who would tell the residents of East Germany, look what the Americans and look what the British did to you. The Russians didn't, the Soviets didn't do this. And the third source Taylor identifies is David Irving, whose book on the bombing of Dresden was the first book in English on the bombing of Dresden, and an each subsequent edition of the book, the number of dead gets higher and higher. And I have it in History on Trial in my book, showing how he keeps pushing up the number of dead in Dresden. Now, you may think, well, how did Irving, who wrote a book on history, have such an impact on our notion, our popular notion of the bombing of Dresden? Well, there was an American prisoner of war in Dresden. Who was very traumatized by the bombing, wrote a book about it afterwards, went on to become one of America's great satirists. And his book on the bombing of Dresden uses as a history source Irving's work on Dresden. And that's Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. So if you want to talk about how misinfluencing of history can get into the mainstream, I think Dresden is a perfect example. We showed that over and over again, Irving based his sources on the bombing of Dresden. I had it, he said, from the chief medical officer that the number of dead was, 250,000. Well, and he named Max Funfack, a doctor who was then alive in Dresden in the 60s when Irving wrote this. Funfack immediately wrote to him and said, I never said that. I wasn't the chief medical officer. I was a private urologist. I didn't have that information. I never said those numbers. And Irving just ignored that. And every time another person who was there when the bodies were burnt in Dresden said, look, I was there when the bodies were being burnt. It's no more than 30,000. And Irving just ignored it. So he would ignore any information which came to him, which he might have disagreed with it, but at least you tell your readers. A solid historian doesn't ignore information that's solid information. You say, look, some argue this, I disagree with it for that reason, but he would just ignore it. The other aspect of the trial, which is also quite important that I want to share with you, is that we talked about his racism. And his anti-Semitism, his virulent hatred of Jews, where he calls Jews cockroaches and talks about them in the most degrading way. But he doesn't only do that with Jews. He does that he says when he's on Australian radio at one point, I feel queasy when I see blacks playing for the English cricket team. Or he gives a speech. We got access through the legal process. There's no deposition of witnesses in British civil or libel trials, but there is discovery where you have to exchange your evidence with theirs. And so we asked the court to give us access to his collection of videotapes and audio tapes. And in one of the tapes, we heard a tape of a speech he gave to his followers. And he gave it just after he had returned from a vacation in Torquay in what's called the British Riviera. And he says, while I was there, I saw very few black faces. And so there's general murmur of applause and appreciation in his audience. He said, now don't get me wrong. I'm happy when I see a black family arriving at Heathrow and happier still when I see them leaving. And then he went on to say, and then I turned on the news and I saw one of them reading our news to us. He said, I'd rather have a woman reading the news. He's a misogynist. You know, it's real. He's not only a racist and a misogynist and an anti-Semite, but he's a terrible misogynist. And they often go together. And none of it is really amusing in that sense. But he goes on to say, what I would like is the important news to be read by gentlemen, the unimportant news to be read by women, and the news of criminals and drug busts to be read by Trevor McDonald. Trevor McDonald is a very venerated newscaster in England. He's now Sir Trevor McDonald because of his years of service. And he is a man from the Caribbean. He's a black man. So that's who should read the news of criminals and drug busts. We also got access to something that people would never have seen, but from the courts we got access to his diaries. And what did we find in his diaries? We found that he writes the following. He then had a 9-month-old daughter, and he writes, baby Jessica is maturing beautifully, and every day I take her for a walk in the pram, and whenever half-breed children are wheeled by, I sing to her, I am a baby Aryan, not a Jew or sectarian. I have no plans to marry an ape or Rastafarian. This is what he sings to his little daughter. So the man's racism is really quite striking. In fact, when he was on the stand, my barrister asked him, Mr. Irving, you've said on the Australian broadcast that you feel queasy when you see blacks playing for the British cricket team. Queasy? He said, oh, Mr. Rampton, you're trying to paint me as a racist. I am not a racist. I just believe God made the species different. anybody who thinks people of color are a different species, I would say qualifies as a racist. He also has very close connections, which we discovered we would never have known this. But when he comes to this country, his speeches and his visits are often sponsored by the National Alliance, one of the most anti-Semitic racist groups in this country. When at one point in his career, he would spend a lot of time in Key West, and he had an admirer in New Orleans who would come down from New Orleans. They played tennis together, and this man happened to be writing a book, and Irving read the book and helped him edit it and thought it was actually quite good. This man's name was David Duke, former leader of the Ku Klux Klan. And we saw that in his connections in England. We saw that his connections in Germany, in terms of the people he keeps company with, which proved my comment about, you know, deniers and racists and extremists being tied up with one another. Let me just talk about the last portion I want to talk about so we have some time for questions tonight. And that is the personal. I've been sort of been telling you the forensic strategy, the historical strategy, what we did. But ultimately, this trial was about what I wrote. And though now, you know, after having won the tremendous victory that we won, where with the judge gave a 355-page judgment, which is, by the way, available on a website established by Emory University, www.hdot, HolocaustDenialOnTrial.org. I mention it in the book a lot. You know, what was the personal impact on me? And now, of course, everybody looks at this verdict and the story and it's come out and says, oh, you did such a wonderful thing and it was so terrific what you did, et cetera, et cetera. But I have to tell you that that's not what I heard in the beginning from a lot of people. And I did hear it from some people. But there were many people who said, oh, Deborah, just ignore this. Now, of course, I don't think they've ever been sued for libel, because I don't think you can just ignore a libel suit even if it's in another country. Unless it's, you know, I don't know, Malaysia, where I don't plan on visiting, but certainly if it's a country I intend to visit, you can't ignore it. And others who said to me, settle. More, that was one thing. But more disturbing was people who said to me, oh, Deborah, don't fight it. Even if you win, you'll lose because he'll get all the publicity. Settle with him. And one day he said this to me, and Anthony was standing near me, and he said, well, what do you think Deborah should settle for? 4 million Jews, 3 million Jews, one set of gas chambers, two set of... In other words, you can't settle. Certain things you can't fight, but certain people you can't settle with. You can't... How do you make a pact with someone with evil and say, okay, well, I'll give you half of your evil or something like that? And there were many people who were very worried and didn't support what I was doing. And it was very lonely at times and very frightening. Took over my thoughts, I kept my mind wrapped around the fact the number of people and institutions who were supporting me. And I do want to mention that. When I mentioned that Anthony and James and the members of their firm worked pro bono, but they could only do that for a while, a limited while. First of all, when they had to start hiring experts and paralegals, money had to be laid out. And plus the fact this was clearly not going to just be over in a short while, but was extending to be a major case. And Anthony called me one day and said, Deborah, we need to raise some funds. We need to get some funds. And I said, well, how much? And he said, a lot. And I said, well, give me a for instance. And he said, well, at least $1 million. So I said, you know, I thank God I earn nicely, have a nice salary, but I didn't have $1 million for a lawsuit in another country. And, of course, when a lawyer, with all due respect to the lawyers here, it's like a contractor. When they tell you $1 million, double it and hope for the best, you know. So I said, you know, I was in Atlanta. I said, you know what, put together a budget and I'll think about it tomorrow, because... That's, you know, last line of Gone with the Wind. I'll think about it tomorrow. I'll worry about it tomorrow. Well, when the budget came, it was already then $1.6 million. And this was with the lawyers working at very reduced rates. And I really didn't know what I was going to do. And it just so happened that around that time, I happened to be with a meeting of a foundation called the Wexner Heritage Foundation, which is supported by a very wonderful philanthropist and in Columbus, Ohio, very active members of the Jewish community, Les and Abigail Wexner. The president of the Wexner Heritage Foundation, Rabbi Herbert Friedman, heard about this, and he said, well, we've got to get organized. And he called Les and Abigail Wexner. He told them what was going on. And Les Wexner said a number of things. First of all, he said, Deborah's name is on the lawsuit, but it's all of us and truth and history and memory which are on the line. And then he said, you know, I could fund this on my own. He said, but when the history of this trial is written, it won't be so good if it sounds one Jew from Columbus supported one Jew from Atlanta. This has got to be a communal effort. And hopefully not just of Jews, but certainly broader than just one person doing it. And he began to get on the phone, and others got on the phone, calling one another quietly, not talking about it. Steven Spielberg supported it, Ed Bronfman's, others, names that are known to you, but nobody talked about it. Because we didn't want Irving to know I had this funds, because we were hoping he'd drop the case. And we thought that if he knew I had this funds, he'd be more inclined to, well, I'm going to really fight her now or something like that. But it wasn't just from people in the Jewish community and some in the non-Jewish world as well that I received support. But my own institution, I teach, as Arden said in the introduction, as many of you know, at Emory University. And long before anybody came forward to talk about a defense fund, I got a call from the general counsel of the university, a man with the improbable name for a lawyer of Joe Crooks. But a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful man who tragically died quite young and didn't live to see the end of the fight, which he would have very much appreciated. Joe called me and said the Board of Trustees of Emory University have had a meeting, and I mentioned the case to you, and they voted to establish a fund of $30,000 to, we're not interested in, we don't know your financial situation, we're not interested in it. We know you're going to have lots of expenses going back and forth to London, and we don't think you should have to be pay this out of your pocket. We ask of our professors that they do their academic research and that they be morally engaged, and we see you as doing both, and we want to support you. Then when it came time for me to, my lawyer said plan on being in London for a 3 to 4 month stay, and it was clear that would be an entire semester. My friend said to me, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I guess I'll take a sabbatical. And a friend of mine who's from a Italian Catholic family said, Deborah, methinks that the word sabbatical comes from a Hebrew word, Shabbat. So you of all people should know that sabbaticals and being on trial are counterintuitive. So I said, well, what do you think I should do? She said, and the academics here will appreciate this, she said, ask for a leave of absence. They're a little easier to get. So I went to the provost of the university, and I said, I'm going to have to be away for 3 to 4 months. And some people have said I should ask for a sabbatical. She said, no, that doesn't sound right. So I said, okay, well, then I guess I should ask for a leave of absence. She says, no, I don't think it should be a leave of absence. So I'm saying, well, what do you think I should do? She said, I don't think you should do anything. We should treat it as if you're teaching, except your classroom will be the courtroom. And all of us will learn from you from afar. And then, just to really even more amazing, shortly before I was to leave, I got a call from the dean saying to me, Deborah, can you find us someone to teach your courses on the Holocaust while you're on trial? I said, yes, but given that they were paying my salary, for them to want to hire someone else was really quite amazing. I said, yes, but how come? He said, well, because we've decided that for us to support you without supporting the students who would be learning from you is to already give Irving a certain victory, and we don't want that to happen. And I say that because so often there's a tendency to, beat up on academic institutions to say they don't, won't support the people there. And I think that this is an important, especially in the night tonight that we're being, this whole visit of mine to Portland is being sponsored by Portland State University, which has done such wonderful work in terms of Jewish history and other aspects of Judaic studies, to talk about universities when they do the right thing and to really laud them for doing the right thing. Just in conclusion, as I said, we won this amazing victory, and the judge's words about Irving in his judgment were incontrovertible. I mean, they just left no doubt what he thought of what Irving had said, and the words he used were, this is from the judgment, direct quote, Irving perverts, distorts, he's misleading, unjust, his versions are unjustified, they're a travesty of the truth, it's unreal. And that he does all this in a deliberate fashion. This wasn't a mistake that he made, but this was deliberate. And the judge went on and on, just demolishing every point that he made. When that happened, of course, all bedlam broke loose in the courtroom. Emails and letters and began to descend on me. This was front page news worldwide, certainly throughout Europe and even here in the United States as well. But I'd like to close by just reading you some of the communiques I received. Some from soft survivors, some from children of survivors, and some from other people who had a connection and who stopped to write to me. On behalf of my grandmother, aunts, uncles, and cousins who died at Treblinka, I thank you. Now enjoy Pesach. because you can doubly enjoy your freedom. Mo Stein. Dear Professor Lipstadt, you do not know me, and we will probably never meet. My mother was killed in Auschwitz. If David Irving had won, my mother would have been a victim a second time. So too would everybody else who perished there. I love my mother very much and have not seen her since April 14, 1939, when I was 14 years old. She was killed on October 23, 1944. Gratefully yours, Anna Bertolina, me, Hannelore Josias. Dear Professor Lipstadt, my husband served with Patton and on a Sunday entered the camps at Dachau. He was a hardened combat veteran, as were the three others who went in with him. They broke down in tears. He recalled an inmate pointing at him and screaming in Yiddish. He had not realized his dog tags, on which he had a teeny bar mitzvah mezuzah hanging, were visible. "Du bist ein Jid?" the inmate asked. "Are you a Jew?" When my husband said yes, he was Jewish, more yelling and others gathered. They couldn't believe a free Jew walked the face of the earth, let alone a Jewish soldier. It took him 28 years to tell me this. He told me when we were in Jerusalem at Yad Vashem. He'd buried the memories of what he'd seen that deep. Cordially, Marion Lieberman. Dear Professor Lipstadt, British justice is a bit long-winded and unemotional. Like the mills of God, it may grind slowly, but on occasion it can grind exceedingly fine. I was a boy during the war, but one thing is ineradicably engraved upon my mind. Not the bombing, which had long ceased, but the memory of sitting in a cinema with my mother and sister weeping, together with the rest of the audience, as we saw the first dreadful newsreel pictures of the liberation of Bergen-Belsen. Fair-haired and light-eyed, Christian, goy, and stranger I may be, but I cannot understand how that dreadful creature persuaded some of our children that their parents and grandparents are either liars or fools. Sincerely, Ray Waters. And finally, an email. Subject, you are the great winner. Dear Miss Lipstadt, my name is Paola Castagno. I'm Italian. I'm 28 years old, and fortunately, I didn't know the Second World War. I read on an Italian newspaper that you won against David Irving. My grandfather Aldo remained 8 months in Auschwitz, like Disneyland. Irving says Auschwitz is Disneyland for tourists. When he came back in Italy, he weighed 34 kilos for 1.82 meter high. He died 3 years ago. I remember that he cried thinking Holocaust after 40 years. He didn't say me nothing about this, so I write to thank you enormously. I know that also my grandfather thank you for your courage and that you speak about truth. Be my great hero. Paolo Castagno. P.S. I'm sorry for my English. I did not feel as if I was anybody's great hero. 5 years earlier, David Irving had, as he told the New York Times, quote, taken me out of the line to be shot, close quote. Fully expecting me, as he said, to crack up and cop out, close quote, Irving may well have been surprised when I fought back as I did, ultimately giving far better than I got. I fought to defend myself, to preserve my belief in freedom of expression, and to defeat a man who lied about history and expressed deeply contemptuous views of Jews and other minorities. For a long time after the court battle was over, I felt pain when I thought of the many people who had watched Irving ravage their memories. I could not fathom what it felt like to have one's experiences not just denied, but deprecated and ridiculed. However, I felt not just pain, but also a certain sense of privilege. I was reminded of the fact that Jewish tradition highly values acts of loving kindness, including visiting the sick, sheltering the needy, feeding the hungry, and welcoming the stranger. There is, however, one act of loving kindness that supersedes all the others because it alone cannot be reciprocated. Taking care of the dead is called chesed shel emet, the most genuine act of loving kindness, because it is then, Jewish tradition postulates, that we most closely emulate God's kindness to humans, which also cannot be reciprocated. For 5 years, I had the privilege to do chesed shel emet, to stand up for those who did not survive,
and who could not stand up for themselves. Being able to do that was thanks enough. I did not choose this field of research in order to perform this act of hustle. I did not write my book under my house expecting to engage in this act. I did not choose this path. And now as I look back, I am filled with gratitude. If someone had been taken out of the line to fight this battle, I feel gratified to have been the one. Thank you very much.
Following the presentation, we will open up to questions from the audience. The first question referred to David Evans, who was in Austria.
There was a lawyer in front of us. A lawyer in front of us because there's a law in the books in Austria from 1947, not about Holocaust denial, but against minimizing crimes of the third world. So any kind of minimization of the crimes of the third world, which includes denying the Holocaust, is against the law. He had done given speeches denying the Holocaust, and there were two warrants that he wrote. They announced on his website that he was going at the invitation of a group of right-wing extremist students, and they were close to neo-Nazi students, I'm going to understand. And the student, I never knew where he was coming. The students not even themselves told the police where he was going to be, because I knew exactly where he was coming. It's a feeling being that some people suppose that he may have wanted to get arrested just to get this attention. When he got arrested, he's in jail. This trial's going to be on February 20th, I believe. And I was recently asked by the BBC what I think the BBC report from BBC.com told me. And this is actually, I think his only intention was a little quote. What do you think about Evans having been arrested? And he probably expected to meet me to say, that's the people now for as long as he's gone, he's from right now, but it's a man from the president of the world, he's a little hard for putting in before, you know. I think he should be released. And he asked me to explain. I gave two reasons. First reason, I'm not for support of censorship. I'm a pretty strong supporter of the First Amendment. And there's certain things you can't call for in a crowded theater, and the things you can't say. But within reason, I don't think a speech should be censored, A. B, in this case in particular, I don't think it's strategic. Because I think it turns David Irving into a martyr on the altar of free speech. And it makes Holocaust denial sort of a forbidden fruit. And you know what God said, God forbidden, don't eat from the tree, and boom, they eat from the tree. So don't deny that. It becomes more alluring, not less. And that has raised a lot of comments and controversy, support. Someone did write me an email congratulating me on my forgiveness and my love for David Irving. I want that. Right, if you got that one wrong. Forgiveness in Jewish tradition comes when you say you're not going to do something, you say you're not going to do it again, and I haven't seen that from him in terms of his humiliation and degradation of survivors. And love, no, right. So in that sense, I just think he should go back to his obscurity trial. Anytime his name is mentioned, it's David Irving, who was described by the court in London as a lawyer or a customer, an anti-Semite. Why don't go back to that kind of mention, to that obscurity? Why don't go back to some basement wake up for six people, et cetera, et cetera? But on a different, completely different note to your question about the Holocaust denial we hear from Iran in particular and other places, that's much more disturbing. First of all, it's coming from the head of state, a people influential, and it's certainly Iran and from the head of state,
a man who may in the not-too-distant future have his finger on the button. It is clearly a way of playing to the Arab/Muslim world in terms of, you know, hatred of Israel, wanting to see the destruction of Israel, questioning the legitimacy of Israel. Iran now is considering having, or has announced it will have a conference to explore the truth of the Holocaust. And someone said to me, well, if Irving gets out of jail in Austria, he may go straight to Iran. Let him keep him. But on a serious note, if that does happen, deniers will get much more attention than they ever have before. And it's going to be necessary to think very strategically how to respond to that. And I'm not sure yet exactly how that is, what should be done. But I find it very disturbing. The one place, a Holocaust denial in much of the Western world is really currently on the ropes. Not only, but in great measure in part because of the trial. The deniers themselves say it. We had our best shot with the Lipstadt trial, and we failed miserably. simply. And there was a court, you know, a court that gave them their chance, and they lost on every point. But in the Arab-Muslim world, it's on the ascendancy, and that's quite disturbing.
Attention all KBOO members. There is an orientation for those of you considering running for election to the KBOO Board of Directors. The orientation is Saturday, July 29th, 10 a.m. to noon at KBOO. You will have the chance to chat with current board members about the responsibilities and opportunities that come with being on the board of directors, and also what kind of work is ahead for the board over the next year. That's an orientation for prospective board members, Saturday, July 29th, 10 a.m. to noon, at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th. See you there.
We're just listening to Dr. Deborah Lipstadt on History on Trial, My Day in Court with David Irving. David Irving was convicted several months ago. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
I think there's a tendency to think about wildlife as something that's out there beyond the urban landscape, that we protect the urban habitat for people and the lands beyond for wildlife, and that's really an inaccuracy.
We got to start thinking of the streets as sort of tributaries to the watersheds that lead to the Willamette and the Columbia River, because that's exactly what they are.
It's a miracle that you can plant a seed and it starts off and it's just this tiny little plant, then all of a sudden it just and becomes huge.
The Whole Communities Radio Project presents Urban Green, a new radio documentary by Barbara Bernstein. Urban Green looks at how our connection to the place where we live is strengthened by eating locally grown food and learning to relate to the watershed we live in, as we search for the ribbons of green in the city that connect us to the natural world. Tune in to Urban Green on Monday, July 31st at 10 a.m. on KBOO 90.7 FM, your community radio station.
Stay tuned for Pat McGuire. This is the Friday Morning Radio Zine.